This is part 2 of 3.
After a long day of fighting rough seas in the Strait of Georgia, the Perse Seiner turned into a cove protected by huge cliffs and dropped anchor. Marco was half dead from the cold and lack of food and water. He meowed softly as if to comfort himself.
"What was that?" cried Scott, who was near the skiff. "I could swear I heard a cat."
"You're crazy," replied Mark the cook. "What would a cat be doing around here? Maybe it's an animal on shore, and the sound just carried like it was here."
"Maybe," said Scott, but he didn't sound convinced. Marco was so sick and cold that he forgot to be afraid of humans. He meowed again. Scott's voice reminded him of safety and food, like when he was a city cat with a nice master and a warm apartment.
"There it goes again," declared Scott.
He started to search around the boat and along the sides of the deck. Then he looked into the skiff. Marco backed into a space under one of the seats.
"Well, look here," said Scott. "It is a cat."
He reached out for Marco, but instinctively defending himself, Marco snaked out a paw and raked Scott's hand with his claws.
"Ouch," yelled Scott, pulling his hand away. "Boy, this is one mean cat."
"I bet he's just scared," said Don. "If he came aboard somewhere, maybe at Bellingham, he must have been hungry a long time."
Chapter 5. Don went to the galley and mixed some dried milk with water, pushing a bowl of it cautiously toward Marco. Ears flat, he still crouched in the farthest corner of the skiff. Don and Scott backed off to watch. When neither man came close to him, both standing perfectly still, Marco gradually crept curiously toward the bowl. The orange cat smelled the milk, then put out his tongue to taste it. All the time he kept one eye on the men, ready to retreat if they came near. The taste of milk was so delicious, and his hunger so great, that he lapped and lapped until the bowl was empty.
"Look," said Scott, "the poor fellow's half-starved."
"Yes," observed Don, "but he's not so thin. He must have been well-fed, not a stray cat. Maybe he came aboard from that island, or maybe he was wild."
"Who knows?" said Scott.
The captain came to see what was happening. "Aha," he said in a rough voice. "It's a cat, is it? Well, we won't have any cats on my boat, not with all the fish aboard. And this explains the mess of crumbs on the galley counters, too. I was about to accuse one of you guys of a midnight raid on the cake."
"Ah, come on," said Scott. "We can't just heave the cat overboard. Let's just take care of him till we get to Alaska and then put him ashore."
"We'll look after him," agreed Don.
He stretched his hand toward Marco, who stayed by the precious milk bowl, but growled low in his throat, warning Don away.
"Well, okay," agreed the captain reluctantly, "but keep him out of my way. I don't like cats much."
For several days, Don and Scott took turns feeding the cat and talking softly to him. Soon Marco hardly moved when the men stretched out the food bowl toward him. Sometimes he permitted them to stroke his back and head. Marco still was watchful and suspicious, but he gradually responded to the food and friendly manner of the sailors. As he gained confidence, Marco moved around on deck, exploring everywhere. When he peered hopefully into the galley during dinner preparations, the cook grinned and often gave Marco bits of food. The captain grumbled, though, and pretended to kick him. Oddly enough, it was the captain who seemed to fascinate Marco. Or maybe it was the pilot house. Keeping a watchful eye on the captain, the cat jumped up on the chart table to look outside at the waves. He liked to stare at the movements of the boat's instruments, reaching out his paw to play with them, as a cat plays with a moving string. The captain couldn't help himself. He had to smile at the sight.
"Look at that crazy cat," he said to Don. "He's going to attack the compass."
At night, Marco now slept in comfort at the foot of Don's or Scott's bunk, snug and warm out of the chilly coastal breeze.
"Don't get any ideas about keeping that cat," the captain still ordered. "He goes ashore soon."
After many days at sea, always moving north along the coast, the boat came out into the broad Queen Charlotte Strait. Here the water often was very rough, and Marco awakened and slept, feeling uneasy. When the ocean was rough, the sailors were busy, too, checking that the skiff was secure, that the chains and lines were lashed down, and taking turns fighting the wheel. The water became calmer near Queen Charlotte Island, and Marco took his place on the chart table again. From there he could see big totem poles on shore, carvings as tall as a house with terrifying faces on them. Most were old, their formerly bright faces worn gray by the wind and rain. Grass grew tall around them, and moss hung in the nearby trees. It looked very spooky to Marco. Don was reading a book about the Haida Indians that lived on the island. "Did you know that these poles told the story of the carver's life?" he told Scott. "Or that of someone for whom he carved the pole?"
"Yes," answered Scott. "The captain says the totem poles also have something to do with the religious beliefs of the old ones."
Time was growing short, for reading or loafing. As the boat entered the northern part of the Gulf of Alaska, the captain planned to fish for a while before moving on into Bristol Bay. Other fishing boats, colorfully painted and ready for the salmon runs, were already in the waters. Some were gillnetters that hung their nets where fish were known to travel. Others were purse seiners, like the Anna Marie. Farther out to sea, trollers fished with long poles and trawlers with nets. The seiners were larger than the gillnetters and used a long net strung out in a circle to catch the salmon. As the crew readied the boat for fishing, one would have thought Marco was the captain. He watched every move the crew made, but made sure he steered clear of the crewman's big boots. Since Don was the skiff man, Marco jumped into the skiff when his buddy went to make a set. To the sturdy skiff, about 16 feet long, moved by a powerful engine, Don attached the heavy net being fed out by the purse seiner. While Marco sat in the bow seat to supervise, Don ran the skiff straight out from the mothership. It was cold, rough work, with waves often splashing over the bow and soaking Marco's fur. He dug his claws into anything he could find, but stayed in the bow. The other fishermen laughed and called Marco the assistant skiffman, while the red-bearded captain muttered and growled about, "Cats, what am I doing with a cat on my boat?" The purse seiner pulled the net around into a big circle until it met with the skiff once again. Now Don tossed a line to the sailors on deck to attach his end of the net back onto a high boom about 15 feet above the deck. That task completed until the next set, Don tied the skiff to the far side of the seiner. He headed the powerful skiff at right angles to the bigger boat to keep the seiner from drifting over the net. With both ends of the net attached to the boom, the fishermen wound it in. All wore raincoats and boots because the wet net dripped salt water on them. As the net was drawn closer to the boat, it closed up on the bottom to form a bag or purse to trap the fish. When the net began to close, the sailors and Marco began to see fish jumping in the purse. It was very exciting, and Marco's short white tail quivered with anticipation. The fishermen pulled and pulled to bring the final purse on board. Salmon, and sometimes odd sea creatures, spilled out onto the deck, flopping and splashing. The men threw the salmon into the fish hold as fast as they could. Other kinds of fish and salmon too small to keep went back into the sea. Sometimes the fishermen tossed a small fish over to Marco for his lunch. The captain noticed this, but just snorted and grunted his disapproval. Marco wasn't as afraid of the captain as before. He sensed that the captain talked tough, but sometimes, when no one was around, the captain actually petted Marco. And he didn't fuss about Marco sitting on his chart table. He even talked to Marco some days, just as if he were a person, while the boat went along through the water. The salmon that were kept in the hold, or a big box that contained them, were sold every day. When the hold was full of fish, the captain tied up next to a much larger fish processing boat, or a fish buyer's boat. This boat stayed near the fishing grounds, so the purse seiners did not have to go ashore. After 3 days of fishing, all the boats were required to stop fishing. This way, some of the salmon could escape to have baby salmon that could grow up for future fishermen to catch. Chapter 6. 5 species of salmon live in the sea near Alaska and off the coasts of Washington and British Columbia. Their common names are King, Sockeye, Silver, Pink, and Chum. These salmon are called anadromous, meaning they are born in fresh water and move into salt water later. Within 2 to 7 years after birth, the adult fish travel home in early autumn to the very stream in which they were hatched. Even the scientists do not understand fully why this happens. The salmon fight any barrier to get home. They jump up through surprisingly high waterfalls and wriggle up shallow streams. Sometimes their backs stick out of the water and they scrape the sand. When the female salmon finds the right spot, she uses her tail to brush aside weeds and dirt. She makes a smooth, flat place on the sand, then lays hundreds of small eggs. She moves a little way upstream and brushes out a new place for eggs. Her sweeping of that patch covers up the first eggs. After she has laid her eggs, the male salmon comes to the same place and puts a substance called milt over the eggs to fertilize them and start growth. After the parent salmon complete the planting of their eggs, their life is almost over. Ever since they entered the river or stream, they have not eaten. Now they float downstream and die within about 2 weeks, washing up on shore, or are captured by bears, raccoons, or birds as food. The salmon eggs hatch in 2 or 3 months into tiny fish that have a yolk or food sac attached. 2 to 3 months after hatching, these babies do not need the food sac anymore, and they come up from the gravel into the water. Some salmon fry, as the tiny fish are called, go directly out to salt water, but most stay in the stream for several months. They grow rapidly, eating fish smaller than they or bugs or plankton, a fish food that exists in most waters. After they go to sea in summertime, the salmon often travel very long distances before they return home to spawn or lay eggs. The tiny fry that left home as a 5-inch fish may return as a huge adult. In Alaska, a fisherman once caught a 126-pound salmon thought to be 7 years old. The government regulates the amount of salmon the fishermen may catch, so adult salmon escape to lay their eggs. If they did not, perhaps there would not be enough small fry coming back into the salt water for future years.
End of part 2. Continued in part 3.